This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The Chinese are now the largest energy consumers in the world. They've just recently passed the United States. And the growth rate of their wind industry, they were doing nothing, and now they're coming on gangbusters and could well pass the United States here in the near future.
Today on Sea Change Radio, part two of our two-part series on wind power. First, we hear again from U.S. Congressman Jerry McNerney, the only member of either house who's also a wind power engineer. Next, the U.S. is lagging far behind Europe in the move toward renewable energy sources. To find out why, we talk once more to Michael Payne, a wind power executive who's worked in Europe and the U.S. He offers his perspective on the policy and business factors that will help direct the winds of change. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Congressman Jerry McNerney, who represents California's 11th District. Congressman, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Well, thanks.
So how are you converting your experience as a wind power executive into action as a U.S. congressperson?
Well, I really like to think of myself as a wind power engineer and a technology developer rather than as a corporate executive. I just had a small business as a startup, but the thing is that I learned a lot about the technology, about the developing of the technology, and what happens when you develop technology, how it gets into the marketplace. If we don't have good policies in this country, the technology is liable to be shipped overseas. I saw the technology personally that I developed shipped overseas to Europe and India and produced there and sold back to us. So that was what made me so anxious to get involved in politics and one of the reasons anyway, and try and make a difference in terms of instituting the right policies that encourage production of equipment in this country so that we can take advantage of the technology we developed here.
And do you think tariffs might be a solution in some of these cases? It's kind of a dirty word in our free trade mantra that's been perpetuated for the last couple decades. But a lot of people forget at the dawn of the 20th century, a significant portion of U.S. GDP came from tariff income, right?
Well, it did. That was before the income taxes. But what I'd like to see isn't so much tariffs as incentives for our utility companies to buy more renewable energy. If you have a big incentive for companies, for the utility companies to buy electricity produced from wind and solar and geothermal, that'll give those startup companies producing that equipment, that'll give them incentive to put their factories here in this country. And I've seen it happen, and I've seen them go away. If the market demand is here in this country, production will be in this country as well of the equipment. So I want to create jobs. Not only that, but if we have those types of energy resources installed in our country, they take labor, you need maintenance, you need people to operate them, and so on. So it's a good source of jobs, it's a good source of tax revenue for local communities, it's a good source of supplemental revenue for farmers and ranchers. So it's really a win-win for everyone if we can get there through the right incentives.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Altamont Pass for our listeners? That's an area within Congressman McNerney's district that's basically a bunch of grassy hills just covered with hundreds of wind turbines.
In the 1980s, the incentives were there to start in developing wind energy and installing wind turbines, and this became the leading area in the whole world for wind energy development, for technology development, and I got in on it pretty early in the program. It was an exciting time because we were developing new technology. We made some mistakes, and it was just an exciting time to be in the program and to see what happened. And now to see that the industry is maturing and that it's taking hold around the world, it's just a very exciting thing for me.
Well, it must have been a little more liberating back in the Wildcat days to just worry about making it work as opposed to making it a scalable solution for millions of people around the globe, right?
Oh, we had a lot to learn. You know, I mean, every little bit of that wind turbine represents a steep learning curve, like the how the blades tie into the hub is a big technology. The controller is a big technology. The foundations, how to make those cost effective. The generator and the gearbox, all of those things. And you know, when I first started in the business, we got a grant to develop the technology. We put together a machine. We thought it was great. We did all the calculations, and we got the investors out there. We planted the ground. We got the investors out there, turned on the switch, and it started turning, and then the blades all flew off, and everyone had to run for cover. And so it was quite a learning curve after that, but it was sobering. And the thing that I really appreciate is that our investors stayed with us, and we kept working on it. We learned about those blade root attachments. We learned about the transmissions and the gears and the generators and all the things that need to be. And over a period of years, we just saw the technology mature, and now it's a great leading source of new energy. So if you have something you really believe in, you know, just stick with it, work hard. You know, your investors will stay with you, and you can change the world. So I think that was a really exciting thing to go through.
And the intermittency issue with wind seems to be one that keeps rearing its head. Where do you think some of the patches will come from? Do you think it's going to become mostly from technological advances in wind, or do you think it's going to be from a smarter grid?
Well, I mean, that is one of the questions about wind energy. It's intermittent. It's only available when the wind blows. But there is technology emerging. I mentioned smart grid because some of these vehicles and vehicles for the future is that these vehicles have a tremendous storage capacity, and if they're parked in the garage at night and the utility company needs a surge of power, they can reverse flow and take a little bit of power from all these cars and keep the grid stable or keep the frequency and the voltage stable. So that's one opportunity. I think we're going to be seeing more energy storage technology developed that can supplement wind and help the transition for when the wind dies. So there's a lot of things that are going to come into play. The exciting thing is that right now the technology is developing. So if you want to get out there and help develop technology, there's great areas to get in there and make a difference. So it's not over. We're still moving forward.
Representative Jerry McNerney, he's the congressman from California's 11th District. He's also a former wind energy engineer. Congressman, thanks for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Alex.
Had we lived, I'd tell it true. Nothing is ever too late. Plow the sea and work the wind. Learn to labor and to wait.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise. My next guest on Sea Change Radio is my good friend Michael Payne, who's been the director at Enron Wind and the general manager of business development for Europe and Asia for Shell Wind Energy. Michael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Michael, you've worked in the wind industry all over the world and have had a chance to look firsthand at what's working and what's not. Maybe you can tell our listeners an example of one project that is really taking off and why, and contrast that with something that hasn't worked as well here in the U.S. and what lessons we really can learn from that.
In terms of the wind energy industry, I mean, the most fundamental thing is a commitment to the Kyoto Protocol and the climate change issues there. So, you know, what you saw in Europe with the European most of the member states, well, all of the member states embracing the Kyoto Protocol is a willingness to implement legislation over the longer term to create a platform for growth for renewable energy. And that was something that we just were never able to deliver, or we have not been able to deliver yet in North America. And you know, the result there was that companies could move forward investing in infrastructure, building plants, hiring people, making commitments in the long term to grow the wind industry sectors. And as a result, you have, you know, places like Denmark, which have, you know, periods of the year when 100% of their electricity is coming from the wind, when demand is low and wind energy production is high. You know, there are other countries, other parts of Spain and Germany where the numbers are up in the, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50%, depending on, you know, the sort of combination of conditions of wind and load. In the United States, I think we will get there over time. It's just unfortunate to have to take sort of a slow path to do that. And it, you know, it all comes back to the issue of regulation and getting the laws in place, because we certainly have the resources in the United States. We have the land, we have the wind, and, you know, we have the technology and the capital to do it. It's just a question of the political appetite.
What are some of the projects that you've been working on, and how would they relate to some of the challenges that we're facing here in the U.S.?
I spent basically 5 years working on the first Dutch offshore wind projects just off the coast of Egmond aan Zee near Amsterdam. And that was a similar sort of project, slightly smaller in terms of size, but just being the first project in the Netherlands, it basically was about 8 years under development from the time we started until commercial operation. And it was opposed by a variety of different groups, you know, ranging from people that didn't want to be able to see lights from the tops of the dunes in the evenings to people who just didn't want to be able to see it at all from their houses or apartments on the coast. But ultimately, it was approved by the Dutch government, and it was constructed, and it's operating and is out there today. It's the, you know, one of two projects in the Dutch waters offshore, and there are a whole host of other projects which are coming down the pipeline. So, you know, I think what you saw in the Netherlands was the third country in the world to develop an offshore project. So the first offshore project was a large size, was built in Denmark, the Horns Rev project. Then you had the UK and then the Netherlands. And now, you know, there are projects under development and being constructed in Germany, and people working on things in the United States, but the Chinese have already put turbines offshore as well.
The U.S. actually has the largest installed wind power capacity of any country, but it pales in comparison as a percentage, right?
That's correct, yeah. And it's only recently that it's taken that position away from Germany. So Germany is a country with, you know, a much smaller population, much smaller land mass, and quite frankly, pitiful wind resources, but they have had a strong will to develop the industry, and as a result, they have companies which are world leaders, and they're number two in terms of total installed capacity of wind, having only recently been surpassed by the United States. Now, you'll see, you know, India and China come up, and the Chinese are now the largest energy consumers in the world. They've just recently passed the United States. And the growth rate of their wind industry, they were doing nothing, and now they're, you know, coming on gangbusters and could well pass the United States here in the near future. So I think, you know, going back to the first offshore wind park Egmond aan Zee project in the Netherlands, you know, the learnings were really around how much effort it takes, not just from the project developers, but from a wide variety of support groups that are nonprofits that are pushing to make these things happen, to, you know, government workers that are in jobs putting in place, you know, regulation around permitting, changing the laws, you know, around the offshore environment. What's the impact going to be on people that have concessions to extract sand from the seabed, you know, and are already out there? What about the Ministry of Defense, who, you know, practices their bombing runs in the same space out in the open water, and, you know, the marine shipping industry and the dolphin lovers. And, you know, there's so many different things that go into delivering a project. It simply takes a fair amount of time and energy and effort to get all of those things lined up. And that's going to be true in any sort of democratic country. Less true in other sorts of systems.
Where are the trends moving in the U.S.? I mean, we've gone from, yes, it's increasing, but the rate seems to be a slow, steady pace. How can we replicate what China's doing? And is that something we should strive for?
Well, I guess I would say we will not be able to copy what China's doing, nor do we necessarily want to. I mean, I think what China's doing may be the right solution for China. And you know, there's a whole subcontext in China of a transition from global suppliers of wind turbines to domestic or local suppliers of wind turbines. So not only are they ramping up their installed base incredibly rapidly, they are investing a lot of money in totally new wind turbine companies, which may, while it's great for building a local industry, may result in lost capital or destroyed value from the the Chinese people's perspective as that technology fails to deliver the returns that maybe more proven technologies would. So we can only look at that and say it's going very fast. They're very aggressive about their growth there. And just reading the New York Times this morning, they're looking at doing similar sorts of things with green transportation, with electric and hybrid vehicles. And I think overall that'll be great for the planet and the world. But we have a very different system here, which is driven by private investment. It's driven by the capital markets. And the return on the investment has to be there in order for the system to be sustainable.
And that leads us to what you were talking about with regulatory issues and also incentives from governments. Because the countries that are really having a major, that are taking a major chunk of their energy problem and tackling it with wind, like Denmark, those are heavily government subsidized industries, correct?
They are. And even, the energy industry in Denmark, the Danish Oil and Natural Gas Company, which actually took over the two big power utilities there, is owned by the government. So, they are investing at rates of return that we simply, can't match in North America, where the private sector is doing it. And, they're subsidizing the UK government as well by investing in the offshore wind industry in the UK. And, they're the lowest cost of capital to do that. And that's great for the UK citizens who are able to increase their percentage of offshore wind without having to put their own money into these wind farms. And the Danish taxpayer is effectively shouldering that burden, which is, sort of an interesting phenomena. At the same time, their turbine supply industry is growing rapidly as they sell the equipment, from Vestas to, which is one of the leading suppliers to a lot of these projects. So, it's not a totally altruistic behavior. It's also closely linked to job creation and the sustainability of their overall economy. But going back to what is going to happen in the U.S. and should we be copying China, I mean, I think the one area where it would be nice to be copying China is to be a bit more aggressive in our goals around how fast we can increase the percentage of wind energy in our total mix.
Because the wind is high, it blows my mind.
This is Alex Wise. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is wind energy expert Michael Payne. So can you tell us a little bit about who are the major players in the U.S. wind industry?
Yeah, I like to break the industry down into equipment suppliers and companies which own and operate assets. And there's maybe a third category, which is sometimes overlapping with the owners and the operators, and that's who's developing the projects. And in terms of equipment suppliers, the major suppliers in the U.S. are the major suppliers on the global level. They are Vestas, General Electric, Gamesa. Gamesa is a Spanish company. Vestas is Danish. General Electric, obviously, is American. You have Suzlon, which is an Indian company, which has moved into the top 10. You have Siemens is the other big one. It's a German company, but it bought a Danish company called Bonus and integrated that into their business a while ago. So you have a lot of other new entrants that are trying to increase their market share, but those are some of the big turbine suppliers. In terms of the owner-operators, the market leader in the U.S. by far is a company that used to be called Florida Power and Light, and it's their unregulated subsidiary. They've changed their name to NextEra. And then you also have European players that have made acquisitions and are now major players. So Iberdrola, which is a big Spanish utility, bought PacifiCorp Power Marketing, which was a Portland-based project developer, owner-operator, and they are one of the major players now. You have the Germans in the market through their utility E.ON, which are significant players, and others like that.
In the U.S., we've heard a lot about T. Boone Pickens and his efforts. How do those measure in scope on a global level?
Oh, they don't really, to be honest. I mean, he, what measures on a global level is the amount of money he spent on his communications and press some months ago. And he was out on the television and doing the speaking circuit, talking about the benefits of wind and his projects. But in terms of what he's actually delivered, I think he's still in the early stages of implementing his plan.
My guest is Michael Payne, who's worked for both Enron and Shell Wind Energy for the last decade. Michael, why are companies like Shell and Enron in the industry, and are they expanding their reach into wind, or are they actually, is it part of the greenwashing efforts of a huge company like Shell?
Well, I think the nature of the energy industry is that it's huge, first of all. We have to keep in mind how big oil and gas is compared to the renewable energy sector, and it's just vast. That's one fundamental thing that you have to look at and you say, gee, what's going on? The other issue is the growth rates in the renewable energy sector are high. So, I mentioned earlier wind has been growing at 30% per year compound annual growth rate. That's a very attractive industry to be in because it's a rising tide that will lift many boats. So as people look for growth in earnings and revenue, they're attracted to that aspect of it. On the flip side, you have a risk profile which is significantly lower than the oil and gas industry. So when people are investing in oil and gas assets, the rates of return that they can generate are higher because these are riskier. It's a riskier business. And so, without going into sort of a finance lesson, it's difficult for the oil and gas sector to make substantial investments in power in general and wind specifically because the risks are lower and the returns are therefore lower. There are other investors that are willing to invest at a lower return. And if you're an oil and gas company, you simply have to invest in other oil and gas assets to maintain a higher return to keep your profits competitive with your peer group.
These enormous companies obviously have the future of energy in their hands because they have the deep pockets. And if they make the investments in renewables on a mass scale, then we really could see some change. Or if governments can do it, like in Denmark and China. But you're saying it needs to come from across the entire oil and gas industry, or is there another way for that to occur to make it cost competitive?
Yeah, I guess my personal view is that I believe in the capital markets. I believe in competition, and I believe in the market economies. And I think that the risks should be taken and borne where they can be best managed, and by people that are best positioned to deal with them. So, I fundamentally don't believe that oil and gas companies should be in the business of making renewable electricity, simply because they are fuel suppliers and they're not power companies. So they have dabbled in it, but really the logical place for renewable energy, to be delivered is by utilities, power companies, power developers, and it's electricity, and it goes with the electricity grid. So forcing oil and gas companies to get into this business through regulation is like forcing the pulp and paper industry to get into it or forcing, the chemical industry to get into it. And I think each of those industries need to be contributing to carbon emission reductions in their own way. And I believe in an overall cap and trade system, that forces all of the players in the market to reduce their emissions where they're most cost efficient, but I don't think that requiring oil and gas necessarily to, you know, participate in renewable energy or hybrid electric vehicles or anything else, you know, that's outside of their segment is the logical place to do that, because it's just, A, they don't have necessarily the core competencies and the skills, but, you know, I think their dollars could be better invested in other carbon emission problems that they have.
We had Stuart Brand, one of the fathers of the environmental movement, who's now pro-nuclear, saying that one of the real issues that makes nuclear such a viable option compared to renewable sources like wind and solar and geothermal is that the base load is not an issue. If you were talking to somebody who is criticizing or saying that that's a hurdle that we really can't overcome, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think personally, I feel like nuclear is an important part of the solution as well. And you know, I've moved from having great concerns about nuclear energy in my youth to being an advocate for a lot of our baseload being met from nuclear power generation. And I just don't feel as though we will be able to make the changes to our carbon production or carbon emissions that we need to make without it. So, you know, a system whereby we have 40 or 50%, 60% nuclear power generation, and then a lot of renewables on top of that, and then some gas on the margin to help smooth the balancing is, I think, the type of system that we need to be moving towards across the planet.
But as a wind energy executive, Michael, tell our listeners, how do wind and nuclear compare as energy solutions?
The wind can't match nuclear is because it's intermittent. And while there is some diversification benefit by having wind generating assets spread across a broader region, you do have weather events that result in, you know, the wind blowing across a broad area or not blowing across a broad area at the same time. So, you know, to be fully reliant upon wind is just not going to happen. You know, that doesn't mean that we can't have wind generating assets that are equal to, you know, at full capacity, you know, 40% of our total consumption, that when the wind is blowing, we're getting 40% of our power. And when it's not blowing, you know, we're getting zero, you know, from that, and we're getting the rest from everything else. But if you think about it, we just need to have more assets that are more diversified into lower carbon technologies. And in the past, we, you know, if our load was 100, we could have 100 of capacity spread between coal and nuclear and some hydro, and all of that was pretty dispatchable, and that was a pretty efficient, cost-efficient pool of assets to meet our needs. Now maybe we're saying we're going to need 150 to meet a demand of 100, and some of it's going to be operating sometime, and parts of it are going to be operating, not going to be operating, and that's less efficient, but in order to achieve the low-carbon solution we need for society, that may be the best answer.
My guest on Sea Change Radio has been wind energy expert Michael Payne. Michael, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Sidewinder, Alex Wise, and The Beatles. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. Go to Sungevity.com to learn more. Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's SEAChangeRadio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.